Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you, wherever you are. Okay, so let's unpack this topic today. We're talking about microRNAs.
Right.
These tiny, tiny pieces of molecular code. I mean, sometimes they're only about 20 nucleotides long.
Incredibly small.
Yeah. But despite that size, they're involved in regulating, well, almost every major biological process happening in your body. Think of them like the body's volume knobs.
That's a great way to put it. They're dialing down, repressing, sometimes even silencing genetic instructions.
And here's the kicker, the problem we're diving into. When these little regulators go haywire, when their levels are off, it's directly tied to major conditions. Things like cancer, heart failure, even neurodegenerative diseases.
Absolutely. But, you know, for the longest time, studying them meant, well, you basically had to grind up the tissue.
Right, which is, I mean, it's like trying to understand a city's layout by looking at a pile of dust swept up from every single building.
Exactly. You lose the address completely.
You lose the neighborhood. You lose how the cells are talking to each other. All that critical interaction is just gone.
Mm-hmm. Because if you have a disease-driving mRNA that's only really active in, say, one tiny corner of a tumor.
Or maybe just one specific type of neuron in the brain.
Yeah, when you homogenize that sample, the signal from those few important cells just gets drowned out.
Lost in the average noise of all the healthy cells around it.
Precisely. Diluted into oblivion.
Okay. So the whole point of this deep dive, then, is to figure out how mapping the exact location of these molecules, this technique called spatial myRNomics, is finally giving us those addresses back.
And hopefully revolutionizing how we diagnose and maybe even treat these diseases.
So before we get deeper, let's give credit where it's due.
Yes. Today we celebrate the work of the Science for Life Laboratory, SciLife Lab, at Stockholm University, specifically Agustin Robles Ramacho, Yemin Zhu, Marco Griot, and Mats Nilsson, who have really pushed our understanding of spatial myRNomics and the technologies required to map these critical regulators. Their review brings a lot of this together.
Fantastic. Okay, let's lay some groundwork. What exactly are microRNAs? For anyone needing a quick refresher.
Sure. So they're a class of small RNAs, non-coding RNAs, meaning they don't actually provide the blueprint to build a protein.
Right. They're not the recipe itself.
No. They're more like the editor or the production manager. They control how much protein gets made from the recipe. Their main job is what we call post-transcriptional gene regulation.
Which usually means?
It typically means either stopping the messenger RNA from being translated into protein, that's translational repression, or actually tagging the messenger RNA for degradation, basically getting rid of the message.
Got it. And this whole system, it's fundamental, isn't it? The discovery itself was a huge deal.
Oh, absolutely massive. We really have to mention the historical milestone here. Victor Ambros and Gary Rifkin. They won the 2024 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for discovering the very first mRNA, LIN4, way back in 1993.
In C. elegans, the little roundworm.
Yep, in C. elegans. That discovery just opened the floodgates for everything we're talking about today.
And the clinical relevance, as we touched on, it's just enormous. When this regulation goes wrong, pathology happens.
Mm-hmm. Take cancer. You have mRNAs that act like oncogenes, we call them oncomeres, like miR-21, that one pops up, is highly upregulated in loads of different cancer types. It helps drive cell growth.
But then you have the flip side too, right? Tumor suppressor.
Exactly. Like the miR-200 family. They act as crucial tumor suppressors, and often their levels drop in cancer.
And it's not just cancer.
Not at all. In cardiovascular disease, you see really abundant mRNAs like miR-1 and miR-133. Often downregulated when someone has heart failure.
And the brain.
Neurodegeneration, too. We see specific mRNA profiles changing in conditions like Huntington's disease, miR-29B gets overexpressed there. And in Parkinson's, you see increased levels of others like miR-543. They're just everywhere controlling things.
So, okay, if they're so important, why were they kind of ignored by the first wave of spatial genomics? What was the big technical hurdle?
Yeah, that's the key question. Yeah. It really comes down to how standard spatial transcriptomics was designed. It was almost entirely focused on messenger RNA, mRNA.
And why did mRNA get all the attention?
Well, think of it like mail sorting. Most mRNA molecules have something called a poly-A tail at one end.
A string of adenine bases.
Right. And that poly-A tail acts like a universal address label, or maybe a handle, that the standard spatial platforms, like the popular Visium system, use to grab onto the molecules. They're designed to capture anything with that tail.
Okay, but Marinades are short, they're non-coding.
And crucially, they naturally lack those poly-A tails.
Ah, so no handle, no capture.
Bingo. They just didn't have the right sequence for the capture mechanism. So this whole massive layer of regulation, the non-coding stuff, the volume control, it was essentially invisible to those early spatial methods.
Right. Overlooked because the tech wasn't built for them. So fixing that, it sounds like it needed more than one trick, starting with just keeping them in place. Stabilization.
Exactly. You can't map something if it washes away during the experiment. And because Marinades are so small and chemically a bit different, researchers found that during the standard tissue prep steps, like fixation,
they just disappear.
Pretty much. They weren't anchored well enough, so they had to figure out a way to, like, chemically glue them down.
Okay, so what was the molecular glue?
They found that adding a specific chemical, it's called EDC.
EDC.
Yeah, 1-ethyl-3-dimethylaminopropyl carbonadamide, but everyone just calls it EDC. Adding that along with the usual formaldehyde for fixation was the key.
How does EDC work?
It creates a covalent bond, a really strong link, between a specific chemical group on the Marinade, its 5' phosphate, and the surrounding molecules in the tissue matrix.
So it locks it in place, irreversibly.
Irreversibly. It stays exactly where it was inside the cell, but importantly, it's still accessible for detection later on. That solved the wear problem, keeping it stable.
Okay, step one, lock it down. Step two, how do you actually see it? You mentioned two main routes, imaging and sequencing. Let's start with imaging.
Right, imaging techniques came first, but they started small scale, like low plex. The traditional method, in situ hybridization, or ISH, just didn't work well for Marinades.
Why not?
They're too short. You couldn't stick enough fluorescent labels or tags onto that tiny sequence to get a signal bright enough to see clearly against the background noise of the cell.
Okay, so standard ISH was a bust. Then what?
Then came a really big breakthrough around 2005. Locked nucleic acids, or LNAs.
LNAs, what are they?
They're synthetic versions of RNA, like artificial RNA building blocks, but they're chemically modified to bind much more tightly and specifically to their target sequence than standard probes.
Ah, higher affinity.
Much higher. And because they bind so strongly, even to short targets like Marinades, they allowed the first really successful visualizations. They first showed it worked beautifully in whole zebrafish embryos back then.
Okay, so LNAs were the key for imaging. Are there specific methods using them?
Yeah, techniques like Mercury LNA ISH, and another one called Marinoscope, built on this LNA chemistry. They allow really sensitive detection, beautiful images.
High resolution, you can see exactly where the Marinade is within a cell or tissue structure.
Definitely high spatial resolution.
Yeah.
But there's always a but.
What's the trade-off?
Scale. Throughput. These methods are typically single-plex, meaning you look at just one Marinade at a time, or maybe low-plex.
How low is low-plex?
Maybe up to 9 different Marinades simultaneously using clever tricks like nanowells or in-cell biopsy, which is great, but it's not omic scale.
Right. So if you want to see the entire library of potentially hundreds or thousands of Marinades working together in that tissue.
Imaging isn't quite there yet for that kind of scale. You get fantastic detail on a few targets, but not the whole Mirnome. For that, you generally need to switch strategies and go towards sequencing.
Okay. So LNA imaging, great detail, limited scale. To get the big picture, the omics view, we need sequencing. And that brings us back to the original problem, doesn't it?
It does. The missing address label. The poly-A tail.
So how did they solve that for sequencing?
This was the really crucial chemical workaround, the pivot that enabled spatial Marinomics. It's called in situ enzymatic polyadenylation.
In situ meaning right there in the tissue.
Exactly. Before they even take the RNA out, while it's still in the tissue slides on the microscope slide, they use a special enzyme, a polymerase.
To add tails.
To add artificial poly-A tails onto the ends of essentially all the RNA molecules present, including those Marinades that naturally lack them.
Uh-huh. So you give everything the magic handle that the standard capture methods are looking for.
Precisely. Once the Marinades have that artificial tail, they're no longer invisible to the downstream sequencing platforms. They can be captured onto the barcoded spatial arrays, just like mRNA, and then sequenced.
That sounds like a complete game changer, putting the tail on the donkey, so to speak.
It really was. It unlocked the ability to capture and sequence these previously missed molecules spatially.
And the first big proof that this actually worked, that this whole strategy was feasible, came with a technique called STRS.
Right, STRS, spatial total RNA sequencing. They basically integrated this polyadenylation step into the workflow of a commercially available system, Visium.
And what did they find? Did it
It worked spectacularly well.
Yeah.
The key finding was just how much more mRNA they could detect. STRS picked up something like 100 times more mRNA signals, what we call UMIs, unique molecular identifiers.
100 times more.
Yeah, compared to the standard Visi method without the polyadenylation step.
Let's just pause on that. A 100-fold increase. What does that actually mean for understanding biology?
It means we were basically flying blind before when it came to spatially mapping most mRNAs. It wasn't just a small improvement. It was like turning the lights on in a room we didn't even know was there.
Wow.
They went from detecting mRNAs as about 0.004% of the total captured molecules, practically zero, up to 0.4%. Still a small fraction overall, but a massive relative increase, enough to actually start mapping them properly.
And they showed it could track changes too, right, in muscle.
Yes, that was a key validation. They look at mouse skeletal muscle after an injury during the regeneration process. They could track specific mRNAs changing over time and in specific locations. For instance, miR-206 levels went way up after the injury, which is known to be involved in muscle differentiation.
While another muscle mRNA, miR-1, stayed pretty consistent.
Right. It showed the method could capture dynamic, biologically relevant changes spatially.
Okay, so STRS proved the concept. Then came PathoDBT. This sounds like a more comprehensive study.
It was. PathoDBT, published in 2024, is arguably the first really comprehensive spatial miRNomics study. It also used polyadenylation, but combined it with a different barcoding method using microfluidics and, importantly,
they used FFPE tissue.
Yes, that's a huge deal.
Explain why FFPE is so important and maybe so difficult to work with.
So FFPE stands for formalin fixed, paraffin embedded. It's the standard way clinical samples like biopsies have been preserved and archived in hospitals for decades. There are vast libraries of these tissue blocks.
So access to historical patient data.
Exactly. But the formalin fixation process and the embedding can be quite harsh on nucleic acids. Mm. RNA, especially small RNAs like mRNAs, can get degraded or chemically modified. It's notoriously challenging material.
So getting any spatial omics to work well on FFPE is tough, let alone adding this extra complex polyadenylation chemistry for mRNAs.
Absolutely. The fact that PathoDBT successfully applied this whole workflow to FFPE tissue was a major validation. It means the technique isn't just a research lab curiosity. It has real potential for analyzing clinical samples, the samples that pathologists look at every day.
Okay, so what did PathoDBT actually find when they applied this to FFPE?
Well, first, they showed impressive bread. They identified over 1,000 different mRNAs, 1063 to be precise.
Wow.
And they validated known biology. For example, they looked at mouse liver tissue. And sure enough, miR-122, which is famously super abundant specifically in the liver,
was highly enriched right there in the liver sections, as expected.
Exactly. It showed the spatial localization was accurate.
Okay, good sanity check. But what about disease? What did they find in tissues with pathology?
That was the really exciting part. They analyzed human multi-lymphoma samples. That's mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue lymphoma.
Okay.
And they found clear, distinct mRNA signatures localized to specific regions within the tissue. Critically, in the areas identified as containing the tumor B cells, the cancer cells themselves.
Right, where the action is.
They saw upregulation of known oncogenic mRNAs, like that miR-21 we mentioned earlier. And at the same time, in those exact same tumor regions, they saw downregulation of important tumor-suppressive mRNAs, like miR-134 and miR-149.
So the spatial map directly linked the bad actors, oncomeres going up, and the loss of good actors, tumor suppressors going down, to the physical location of the cancer cells.
Precisely. That kind of spatially resolved molecular fingerprint is something you completely lose with bulk sequencing. It gives you context.
Hugely powerful. Now, before we talk implications, you mentioned one other approach, MeEE Hires, a computational one.
Yeah, this one's quite clever. It came out in 2025. It's different because it doesn't actually measure the mRNAs directly using sequencing or imaging.
How does it work?
It infers the activity of a mRNA. It looks at the expression levels of the known target genes of that mRNA, the genes it's supposed to regulate.
Ah, so it looks downstream.
Exactly. If it sees a coordinated downregulation, a silencing of a whole set of known target genes for a specific mRNA, all happening together in a particular spatial region.
It infers that the mRNA responsible must be active right there.
Right. It's like seeing a bunch of lights go out in one neighborhood and inferring someone flipped the main switch for that area. It leverages existing spatial mRNA data to predict spatial mRNA activity.
That's a smart way to potentially get mRNA insights from existing data sets.
Very
cool. Okay, let's pull back. We have these new tools, STRS, PathoDBT, even computational inference. What does this all mean for the bigger picture, the clinical potential?
Well, the ability to see this heterogeneity spatially is massive. for cancer, as we saw with PathoDBT, you can now potentially map these miRNA signatures in really critical zones within a tumor. Think about the leading edge, the invasive margin where the cancer is spreading.
Or the core, which might be hypoxic and resistant to therapy.
Or areas heavily infiltrated by immune cells. Understanding the specific miRNA regulators active in those distinct microenvironments could be key to understanding tumor behavior and finding new therapeutic targets. You're profiling the battlefield in detail.
And for diseases in structured organs, like the brain, this seems essential.
Absolutely critical. Neurodegeneration is a prime example. The brain has such incredibly complex and specialized architecture. Different regions, different cell types doing different jobs, likely relying on different miRNA regulation.
So instead of just saying miRNA levels are weird in the Alzheimer's brain,
you can now potentially say miRXYZ is upregulated, specifically in these neurons in the hippocampus, but downregulated in microglia in the cortex. That level of spatial detail is crucial for untangling these complex diseases.
Makes sense. Same logic applies to immunology too, I guess.
For sure. Think about lymph nodes, or the spleen, these highly organized lymphoid structures. Being able to map miRNA circuits within specific compartments like germinal centers versus T-cell zones could reveal localized immune responses or dysfunctions that were previously averaged out.
Okay, the potential is clearly huge. But it's early days. What are the big challenges still ahead? Where does the field need to go next?
Right, there's definitely work to do. On the imaging side, the LNA-based methods, the challenge is scaling up. We need ways to look at many, many more miRNAs simultaneously through omic scale multiplexing while keeping that amazing single molecule sensitivity and high resolution.
Get the best of both worlds, scale and detail.
That's the dream for imaging. And then for the sequencing-based methods like SDRS and PathoDBT.
They give scale, but what's the limitation?
Resolution. Right now, the spatial spots or barcodes often capture RNA from a small group of cells, maybe 5 to 10, sometimes more, depending on the system. The next big push is to get that down to true single-cell resolution while still capturing the whole miRNome.
Single-cell spatial miRNomics. That's the goal.
That's a major goal. Another key area is integration.
Combining it with other data types.
Exactly. Developing robust methods to layer spatial miRNomics data with spatial maps of mRNA, proteins, maybe even metabolites, all from the same tissue section. Building these comprehensive multi-omics spatial atlases will give us a much deeper understanding of how all these molecular players interact in context.
And the data analysis itself, that sounds complicated.
It is. The bioinformatics needs to keep pace. When you do that polyadenylation step, you add tails to everything, including lots of ribosomal RNA fragments and other things you might not be interested in.
Noise!
Yeah, potentially a lot of background noise.
Mm-hmm.
So we need better computational filters. And we also need new tools specifically designed to analyze the spatial patterns of miRNA activity, maybe looking at interactions based on their seed sequences, the short regions that determine target binding.
Okay. So quite a few hurdles still, but the path forward seems clear.
Yeah. The foundation is laid. Now it's about refining, scaling, and integrating.
All right, let's try to wrap this up. The take-home message from our deep dive today.
I think it's that we fundamentally misunderstood, or at least underestimated, the role of these tiny miRNAs in disease for a long time, simply because our tools couldn't see where they were acting.
Right, bulk sequencing just erased the map.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But now, thanks to techniques like in situ polyadenylation used in STRS and PathoDBT, we can finally start mapping the entire miRNome spatially in 3D within tissues.
And crucially, linking specific miRNA signatures like oncomeres going up or tumor suppressors going down directly to their physical location, even in those clinically vital FFPE samples.
It's a foundational shift. It moves us a big step closer to true precision medicine, where we understand the molecular drivers of disease in their exact context.
So the final thought to leave everyone with, what does this mean for you listening? Now that we're gaining the ability to pinpoint the exact molecular trigger, like a specific miRNA, operating in just one cluster of cells, maybe that invasive edge of a tumor or a specific neuronal population in Parkinson's, how quickly can we actually develop therapies designed to target only that miRNA in only that location? Could we one day tweak the volume knob just in the diseased cells, leaving all the healthy tissue around it completely untouched?
That's the ultimate promise, isn't it? Targeted, localized molecular medicine. That's the challenge and the opportunity that lies ahead. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.